Good evening, everyone. It's great to be back on Thursday evening and to see you all. As you can hear from my voice, I have a cold again. Don't remember if last week I had a cold, but recently in one of the talks I had a cold. I can't seem to like get out of this cycle, but that's the cycle I'm in. So recently in our study group, we've been looking at the precepts, a text from Bernie Glassman about the precepts and the three different ways of looking at them and what it means to violate the precepts or to break the precepts. Different discussions around the precepts. And it so happens that I think yesterday or the day before, I listened to a conference, a video conference from a teacher in our lineage, in the White Plum lineage, who was talking about what we call Tozen's Five Ranks, which is one of the classic texts that we study in our koan practice, very advanced, late in the practice. And he said in the, of course, people started asking him, well, most, I think everyone almost was American who was on the podcast, and said, in our difficult times, let's just restrict it to the United States, although it's difficult in multiple places in the world. What do we do about hateful speech and hateful conduct, And he, because he was talking about the five ranks are about the relative and the absolute and the five ways of different ways of looking at them. He said something. I thought, how is he going to answer this? And after explaining, that judging someone's speech is already dualistic and, if just because someone doesn't agree with me, that's, we're really holding on to a relative point of view. However, he said, if speech harms the Dharma, and he defined Dharma as truth or interconnection, or what points to interconnection, or what embodies interconnection, if speech harms that, or destroys interconnection, then we need to speak out. And this was kind of just a way of furthering the discussion about the absolute and the relative, and the absolute and the relative as one, and functioning as in Bernie's three perspectives of the precepts, the literal, the intrinsic, and the subjective ways of looking at the precepts. It's the same with the relative and the absolute. So how do we hold the two of them and then function in the world? And I thought that was helpful that he was addressing really the American situation, which is full of hate and division and and he said, speak out if speech harms the Dharma or destroys interconnection. He doesn't say get angry. He didn't say, speak hatefully, but to speak to the truth. And so that brought me to look, come back to the precepts we've been talking about. And that at the, for those of you who have received the precepts, done Jukai, so, or even if you've just witnessed a ceremony, you've heard this. At the end, after you've, received each of the precepts, the three pure precepts, the three treasures, and the 10 grave precepts, After each one of those, you repeat what it said, and then I ask you, do you vow to maintain it? And you say, yes, I do, and you bow. And at the end, I summarize, the preceptor summarizes, it's a text that we use, that says, and I'll read what it is because I don't know it by heart. Now that you have received these precepts, the great wisdom is your teacher, and you should not follow dualistic or misleading ways. And then I think probably after that, then there again, it's, you know, you are asked three times, do you vow to maintain this? And three times you say yes and you bow. If you didn't, you would not have received your rakusu and received the precepts, right? However, how often do we really think about what that means? If we look at it from one perspective, you should not follow dualistic or misleading ways. It sounds like misleading ways. We're saying the other ways you could follow are misleading, that we are the only ones. This is the only way that's true. But really, and I think I don't emphasize this enough when I talk about the precepts or Jukai, really this phrase dualistic and misleading is like what Shishin, the guy last night, said. Whatever, it's dualistic and misleading is creating separation. It's creating division. It's not going towards oneness and compassion and no harm. So when we ask you that, you know, you should not follow dualistic or misleading ways, that's what it's saying. It says, you've taken refuge in the Buddha, of course, in the Dharma and the Sangha as well. You've taken refuge, the Buddha, which is, you know, the all-pervading absolute wisdom of, or awareness, let's say. You've taken refuge in that. And then this is saying at the end, so don't follow misleading and dualistic ways. Remember this vow you've taken, and remember not to be caught in the dualisms and the separations that we so often are caught up in, which we see the world around us caught in, right? And we see this in like so many situations in our life, disagreeing with someone. It can even be, you know, about ourselves, judging ourselves, creating these dualisms within ourselves, or projecting onto others, or not respecting positions, you know, or situations. There's a Zen image that this guy last night also reminded me of, that someone who is stuck in the absolute, you know, who only sees oneness and non-separation, right? Because that's a danger, is called a board-carrying fellow. And that, so the image is of someone who is carrying a big plank of wood on their shoulder, you know, like this, like on their shoulder. It's bigger and taller, though. And they're walking down the street and they say, wow, this is a strange city. They only have buildings on one side of the street. And there's only people on one side of the street. Of course, this is just, you know, completely ridiculous image, but that's what we do when we see only the absolute, or on the other shoulder, if we see only the relative. So we're only seeing part of the world when we do this. And so, of course, our challenge, as we know, is how do we hold the two? How do we embody the two, which actually aren't two? However, language and conceptual thought makes it two, which is helpful until it's not. It's helpful until we are caught by it. Until we walk around with a board, you know, because even that board can even serve as, maybe we could carry the board in the middle of our head, you know, and separate, you know, so not see that the two are one. You know, we're separating it for, in two parts, right? So how does this, what does this mean for us? You know, so I'm sitting here and I'm like, oh yeah, I have a cold again and I can't get out of this and it's so frustrating and why is it like that? And I'm always really kind of relieved when I hear people around me are also sick, which is absurd, right? Why am I happy that other people are sick? And I'm not really happy, but it's kind of like, oh, okay. I'm not the only one that's got this, you know, or I'm not, although my husband is like worse than me, and my daughter was sick, and my grandson, and my neighbor. It's like it's all over. It's not just me, but, and at what point do we then identify with being sick, you know, and indulge in it, and poor me, and, become angry about it. At what point do we deny it? Oh, I'm not really sick. You know, I could go out. I don't need to wear a mask and I'm not going to contaminate anyone, or I don't have to do anything. I ran into Debbie actually in the metro yesterday. Was it yesterday? Yes, it was. Or, no, Tuesday. Tuesday. Yeah. And, you know, I had a doctor's appointment. It had nothing to do with my sickness. My current sickness, which I made in, I think, June. It was, you know, like one of these doctors where you can only see like impossible to get an appointment. So I, had I not had made that appointment in June, I would have canceled it. I would not have gone out yesterday on Tuesday. But I had to go. So I wore a mask. So I saw Debbie in the metro. Actually, she didn't say anything about me wearing a mask, but I think I told her I was sick. But anyway, so I responded to the situation. I was not like stuck in like, I'm so sick, I can't do this. And I'm, that doctor was so annoying. If I cancel this, I won't get another appointment until June. You know, all this kind of stuff. The situation called for going out and doing it. And therefore, given the circumstances and respecting the others, not like indulging in my position, wearing a mask. And I kept the mask on in the metro, and I kept the mask on at the doctor's office with the doctor, with the secretary. You know, I said when I had to give my Visa card to pay, and I touched it with my hands. You know, I said, oh, I'm sorry, I'm touching it. And she said, oh, no, don't worry, I'll clean it off after. You know, I tried to be very attentive. I hope I didn't contaminate anyone. I sat right across from Debbie for 10 minutes in the metro. I hope I didn't contaminate her. But, and I got to run into Debbie in the metro, right? Which I would not have happened had I stayed at home. You know, the coincidences of it are just incredible that Debbie should be on that same train. It was not in near her home, and it was not my metro stop, which logically she could have been at my metro stop because she'd been at Donna on Tuesday, right? But it wasn't. It was the next metro stop after that. And it so happened that my car like went past her and we waved, and so she came in. So the circumstances are such that the interconnection and the interdependence of the moment is unfathomable. I did the best I could to protect everyone in that moment, which was part of the moment then, my being sick, my mask, whatever, you know. So if we look at this, you know, I vow to not follow dualistic or misleading ways. So anything that creates separation, and I was reminded recently again of, for some of you who've been around for a long time, maybe no one here has been around long enough. I went through this phase where I was just really, really, really involved with James Joyce and Ulysses, and we did study groups around it, and I gave talks on it all the time on my blog. We did a lot, I wrote about it all the time. And I even did a workshop in New York about it. I did a workshop in Paris, actually. Probably none of you were there. Maybe, I don't know. Tiago did, maybe Tiago was at one of those, I think. Yeah, Tiago was. So I suddenly I remembered this thing about Joyce, where he when he talked about something called beholding, this word in English we have beholding, and English has this way of putting words together that is quite amazing. Like atonement is at one-ment, right? To be the state of being at one. And beholding is so being while holding, or being holding, or holding being, and he used this in referring to experiencing a work of art, specifically in the context of appreciating a work of art. And he said, if you are too close. But this applies to anything in life, right? Okay, this is, if you're too close to the work of art, if you take, like, okay, I have these postcards from the art show that I just saw recently. If I'm like too close to it, well, I can't really see it, I'm like too close and I become identified with it. He called it pornography. If you're too close to it, Joyce did. That's another idea. Or maybe he said obscenity. I can't. No, I think it was pornography. If you're too close to it, you're completely identified with it, the work of art. And then he said, but if you're too far away from it, so that if you're too far away, then it's you become a critic. You're distant from it, and you critique it, and you judge it. You're not close enough to behold it, to be one with it in an appropriate way. You're too far away from it for that. And you then become like above it or outside of it. And you can't really be in contact with it. You're taking positions out, judging and critical positions, which, of course, as we know, art critics, that's what they do. In order, though, for an art critic to do that appropriately, they have to truly behold the work of art. So he said, beholding the work of art is somewhere in between, which is, what we call the middle way, or which is holding the relative and the absolute as one, which is to not be, to not follow dualistic and misleading ways. The dualistic ways would be, to be too distant, me, the work of art, the artist, me, judging, comparing it to other works of art and all of this without seeing the oneness of it. But if we go too close, then we're not seeing the relativity of it. So we're holding the plank, we're only seeing one side of it, right? Of the thing. So what does that mean for us? Well, if we take, like, in our relationships or in our workplace or in our families, even something. So let's say in a professional relationship, if we don't, someone was telling me today that in their work, they've realized that they have to manage up and manage down in the sense of, responding to the boss, the superior. And respecting that position and respecting her position of what is required of her in her daily work and whatever, and her projects, and how then to relate to the boss and what the boss expects, and respecting the boss's position, and also responding to she has a team of people she works with, but she's in charge of that team. and managing their projections, their unhappiness, their jealousies, their discontents, also managing delegating, how to respect their positions and delegate to them and not become too identified, not become too distant. Because it's a workplace, so it's managing, we would say, but it's the same thing. It's the same. How do we, in depending on the circumstance, how do we manage? How do we hold? How do we not follow dualistic or misleading ways? And it always depends, as Bernie points out in this text on the precepts. There's no fixed way. There's no fixed answer. And as he points out in the text, we're constantly violating the precepts. The way that we break the precepts is when we willfully choose to destroy them. And so he said anything short of suicide, which is considered, destroying life, or willfully harming. Anything short of that is just a violation of the precepts, and we atone for it, and we acknowledge it, and we try to maintain awareness around it. And he uses the metaphor of a glass, for those of you who've been in the study group, of we clean the glass. So I'm drinking from this cup, it becomes dirty, and I clean it. If I destroy the glass, well, then that's the equivalent of breaking the precepts if I break it. But just using it requires then cleaning it. That's what atonement means. When we say we atone for all of the, suffering that we've created. So because we take this vow of, not following dualistic or misleading ways, what does that mean then in my life? So, if I'm in a position of authority, so this person telling me in her workplace, I have to recognize the position I'm in, and I have to recognize the position of the other. And I have to honor those positions, and I honor those positions by respecting them and not abusing my power if I'm the one who's in charge, or imposing my agenda, thinking, oh, I know what's best, for that person or for those people. It may be that in the project that you're collectively working on, there is an agenda that needs to be followed. And so that's what you do. And people, you can have discussions about it, but if that's what the agenda is, then that's what needs to be done. And you can best, and then everyone becomes involved in that project. I saw a documentary about the renovation of Notre Dame, which is opening tomorrow, no, Saturday, I think, or Sunday, I don't know which day, but Tiago, I'm sure, has heard about this, and I thought a lot about Tiago watching this documentary, because it was not so much, the documentary is about all of the people who are doing this renovation. From the guy who was in charge of building the scaffolding, which was this absolutely incredible project, which was the fundamental thing, because if the scaffolding didn't hold, they couldn't do any of the work to rebuild the cathedral. And they didn't know all as they went along, whether it would or not, because the charpente, what do you call the charpente in English? What holds up the roof, the ceiling, I forgot the word. It's made of wood anyway, it's made of oak, and it burned and collapsed, a lot of it, but some was still left. And so, but they couldn't build the scaffolding on that because it wouldn't hold. So from that down to, the people who chopped down the trees to rebuild the work, to the architects, to the people like Tiago who are, restoring meticulously. It was absolutely beautiful to see how the work that these people did, and how careful they were, and how they I mean, for Tiago, of course, it's normal because he knows that's what the job is. But for us lay people watching it, it's absolutely astounding. They took apart every window, the stained glass windows, which didn't melt. Most of them didn't melt, but they were dirty, and they hadn't been renovated for 100 years or so, probably even. And they took them out, and they took them out piece by piece, and they meticulously took out the whatever the material is that holds the panes together, and just like lovingly took these panels and handed them to their colleague, and then who lovingly put them into a container that had been built for that purpose. And so they could go to their studio and clean these things. I mean, it's just unbelievable. So all of these people are working together as a team on this one project, right? They all have this project. They knew they had this deadline, which was absolutely outrageous, the time frame they had to do the work. Absolutely, just unfathomable that they managed it because it was such a short time frame. It was 5 years, but when all of the stuff that they had to do, it's just incredible that they did it. But so they knew, and they all knew the constraints they had, and maybe there were some people unhappy about certain things that they had to do or how it went, or they disagreed on things, but everyone was involved in this one project and everyone respected each other's positions. The guys who were building the wooden structure for the roof respected the guys who were cutting down the trees, respected the requirements of the people who were going to build that structure. And apparently for cutting wood, you have to cut wood, cut trees on the darkest day of the month when the moon is dark. So there's one day a month you can cut the trees for it to be appropriate to use for the building. So that means these guys had to cut all the trees down in 4 months. So that means they had 4 days to cut 1,500 oak trees because they wanted to use the same wood. They rebuilt it exactly as it had been in medieval times, right? So oak wood, And so they respected the requirements. The guys building it respected the requirements of the guys cutting it down and vice versa. And then finally, the guys building it said, okay, well, we can make an exception. You can cut it down the day before and the day after the dark moon. So that gives you 3 days a month. So they had 12 days to cut 1,500 trees. And they did it. They all, combined to do this and respected each other's positions. So how does that, this is an example of, okay, so how do we respect our positions as, okay, I'm the boss, or I'm the one who is, not the boss. And or say, in a sangha. The leaders, so the teacher, and we know how often in spiritual communities, the abuse that is caused by leaders who don't respect the positions, who don't respect their position, and who don't respect the positions of the others. And it can be from, it's not only the teachers. It can be the timekeeper. It can be the tenzo. It can be the eno. Sometimes we've had like, I've experienced sessions where the Eno was like a dictator. The chant leader was like a dictator and criticized everyone all the time. Or sometimes, when you're a first-time timekeeper, suddenly everybody who has been around for a while becomes an expert on timekeeping and tells you how to do it. And everybody's giving you different instructions. Or we used to go to a place for our early days of retreats in France, which I think Lisa came once there, but I don't think anybody else came there. Oh, twice you came in Normandy. Yeah. And the person who owned the house, who very graciously gave us use of the house, and I only had to pay like nothing, because it was early days and I couldn't I didn't have any, I never knew how many people would come to a sesshin, and I didn't have any money. And so she very graciously let us use her house. And she was a Zen practitioner, but not, I was not her teacher, and my teacher was not her teacher. But well, what happened was, she became like a dictator. And she had all these, she would constantly tell people, not me, sometimes me, but usually other people behind my back, would tell them they weren't doing things right, would criticize them, would get in arguments with them about things, even called, someone who does practice in the same lineage as me to verify if I was doing the ceremony correctly or something, And it just became, it was just inappropriate. She was abusing her position because it was her place, so it was not a neutral venue, right? And so people were in a position vis-a-vis her because it was her house. And she was doing this great favor to us to let us use her house for very cheap. And so people were in this position of they didn't, they were new to the practice, and she seemed like this expert, and it was her house, and she was telling them what to do and what not to do, and it became to the point where one guy threatened to leave. He didn't come out of his tent for a day because he was so upset. He was very fragile. Joa got in big fights with her. At some point I said, whoa, this is so inappropriate, And I s sat with it, and I realized, I was very grateful to her, and I felt like I'd put her in this really unfair position. That I had put her in this position of imposing a sangha, a way of doing things, a teacher on her in her home. And you know how we are when we go on retreats, we kind of just move in and take over the place. We go to Tiago's house and we just act like it's ours, right? And we don't, and it or we go to Ribamar, or we go to Coimbra, or wherever we go. And we don't mean to do that to do harm, but we sometimes lose sight that it's not our place, and that we are just, someone is making it available to us. And that's a hard thing to hold, right? So, if we went to Tiago's place in the summer and we didn't respect the rules of the land and the homes, and if this is why I insist on giving money to Tiago's family, and why I insist that everybody has to pay for the sesshin anyway and everything, and that we pay for food, even though gratefully they donate food. But to keep the relationship healthy, we have to really maintain this. Because if we become too close, then it's abusive and it's we become too identified with it. So I finally said to this woman, I'm really sorry that I imposed this on you, and that we have done this to you. And it's not appropriate. And I'm sorry for you that, we did this, and that it's not appropriate for us that, you're in this position of giving orders to people. And I'm not your teacher, so I understand that you don't, look to me as the authority. I totally respect that, and I don't expect you to be my student. But it's not appropriate. So, and I thanked her copiously for those first, I think, how many years? We probably went there 4 years, maybe 4 or 5 years, maybe summers. And even in the spring, we used to go too, because I think there were two Jukais there in the spring. So Lisa says she only went there once. Okay. And I thank her, and I'm still ever grateful to her. And when we celebrated our 20th anniversary, I reached out and invited her to come, and she couldn't, but she sent lots of pictures, and she said how grateful she was too that she'd been able to do that. And so all's well that ends well. But just to say that, we have to keep in mind the appropriateness of situations, of positions, of dualistic and misleading ways, you know. So I was caught by my desire to use this place or I needed it, you know, and maybe I let it go on too long. And I also was, it was the beginning of my path as a teacher too, so I wasn't so sure of myself either. And so sometimes I wasn't sure how you do the ceremony, you know, or I was like, okay, well, you know, she was a great cook, so we let her be the tenzo. She was a magnificent cook, you know, and she knew how to do it, and she knew where to shop, and she was absolutely fabulous. But then it just became too much, you know. She had too much power, and it wasn't fair to her either. So, and that's how things become abusive. So her behavior was abusive for the people in the Sangha, and maybe it was abusive of me and the Sangha's part to take advantage of her generosity and not respect. You know, she had ways she wanted things done, and it just didn't work, you know, because when you're doing a sesshin, you can't necessarily do it the way that house normally functions. So all of this just to, you know, say, do not follow dualistic and misleading ways. It's an ongoing, endless vow. Yeah. So maybe I will stop there. I talked much longer than I thought I would because I thought, oh, I have a cold. I'm not really going to talk much. But so if you would like to comment or add the commentaries or questions, reflections. Krisha.
Good evening. Do you listen normally like this?
Yeah, good.
Okay, because I have two. And my girl, she's making some game with the friends. I don't know. She's screaming.
We don't hear that.
Thank you. So thank you very much for your beautiful image of the book, of the postcard, and to much identify and to far away, just judge. Love it. And when teachers in this case you start speaking with us in a with so clear examples, it's something opens to me. It's very important. It's really important. So thank you for that. And well, you talked a lot. No, didn't mean that. You talked about the dualistic, the I cannot repeat the terms you use. What I wanted to say basically is about Zen practice and the precepts, which I didn't make Shukai. I've read them, I've witnessed it. But I also know that we do koans for a lot of time, and sometimes puzzles me a bit. I don't know what to think, but it is what it is. How some people can do it very well, can pass every koan, and still Maybe your image of carrying the clock, or I don't know, how is it possible to make it both? In my life, when you were saying that, I think the most challenging, it's with my daughters, of course, especially my teenager, 14-year-old. I remember these vacations, me and the father, both in our time with them. It's 15 days. Usually we are 1 week yes, 1 week no. So I think it kind of helps because the authority and the when she sometimes tends to get really rude and she really talks back to you. And you just want, to no, you do not do this. I'm the authority. And if you get engaged in the fight, you can say, usually what happens to me, say things I would like not to have said. But then, of course, I have my space. I'm the parent. And w what I found myself doing, it's not just atonement, or I can go there and apologize. I don't have any problem with that. But also remembering I'm the mother. So, yeah, this is not appropriate. You cannot talk like this. This is too much. I don't think you're a little girl. I have to take you off. This usually is the phone. But yeah, this is important for you, and it's also important for me that you speak well to me. And when I gain space, if I get too much into a fight to her, which can be really tricky because I can overpower if I want, and in a fight, I have that feeling sometimes. But I know this is a place I do not want to go. But it's really tricky because they can take you out of your center. Basically, it was that I was remember listening to you. Thank you.
Yeah, it's a good example with children and especially, teenagers like that. Or little smaller children, because it's kind of the same, like a 2-year-old or something. They're looking for, they're discovering the new world and they're discovering their own powers and their own abilities and growing and changing, and they're actually looking for what are the limits, what are the rules, what are the boundaries. And of course teenagers want to push the rules and the boundaries because they're looking for some kind of guidance, although they would never tell you that, but that's we know that's what it is. And I think if we look back honestly, I look back at myself, it was a completely unconscious way of wanting my parents to tell me, stop, don't do that, or something. And as a parent, if we can keep that in mind, like you say, it's important, you say this is important for me that you speak appropriately or whatever you said. We act from this place of wanting to go towards truth, interconnection, compassion, wholeness, rather than what does harm. And if we keep in mind what the point is, what our, as you say, you get pulled away from your center, right? But we can use this as our guides, to keep us, okay, what is it, So in a relationship with children, it's a great one, but it can also be with student, as a teacher, or some of you others are teachers. How do you then behave with the students? You're doing it for not because you want them to be a certain way, but because it's what's appropriate or what you know is beneficial. So, it becomes a fine line because some parents want their kids to dress a certain way or to, do certain activities or something, and they impose it on them, or they tell them how they should be instead of realizing who they are and acknowledging who they are and then working within that context. Same thing with students for teachers. You have to, every student is not the same. And the best teachers are the ones, as Debbie and Joan could probably, or even Marlene and Anna, the best teachers are the ones who we all know we had fantastic teachers when we were growing. If we were lucky, we had at least one great teacher in our school life. And they were the ones who we felt seen by. And they were the ones who spoke to us. And spoke to us as if we were like real people. And they weren't necessarily ones who let us do anything we wanted. And same with parents. Now, if the teacher, we also had abusive teachers. I had an abusive relationship with a teacher when I was in high school. And I mean, I didn't think it was abusive, but it was. I was a student, and the guy was 42 years old, Not good, right? And that's wrong, that does not go towards dualistic, that's dualistic and misleading, right? That he did not see the difference and didn't respect those differences from his position of authority of being the teacher and, feeding off of my projections and not seeing the counter transference. We can go into all the psychology of it, but and the same thing can happen with the adults. There are things that you have to respect the child's position and not engage in inappropriate contact, or inappropriate behavior. Like Krisha, you don't take your kids with you to parties or something, or maybe you do, I don't know, but probably not, I mean, or not, it's not like you're going to go to nightclubs and stay out all night with your kids. No, you might do that yourself, or your kids might wish that you would take them and do that, but it's just not really appropriate. It's not healthy for them. It's not healthy for you, So, but it's a challenge with kids, especially like you say, they push your buttons and they, you lose touch with it. But when you find, when you find that center, like you say, you can feel it and you can feel that it's right. And then you have the strength to say, no, this is what it is. This is, and then you have the strength to also, when something else is appropriate, say, okay, this is okay now, or something, Debbie.
Yeah, thank you for this sort of theme, one of my favorites. I was thinking about at some point, oh, I don't know, about 10 years before I left teaching, up the street from us was the University of Saint-Denis, and there was a the science of pedagogy was one of their departments, and the head of that department came to our school to talk to us about teaching. And he said the first thing you have to ask yourself, and actually, well, it doesn't happen to a parent because a parent has more knowledge, but the first thing you have to ask yourself when you're teaching is, who am I talking to? And it really pierced my perception of, probably in an instinctive sort of way, I was interested enough to ask that question most of the time. But otherwise, it doesn't, there's, you're not teaching anybody anything. You're just talking. You're just sort of babbling. If you're not communicating, if there's no connection between you and the person or the people that you're transmitting something to, then there's no transmission. It really changed my way of thinking. And I think it also to a certain extent may control the desire to be all powerful that comes from being the teacher, the parent, or the prime figure. Who am I dealing? Maybe, well, maybe that's what you were saying actually in these situations, work situations. Who am I talking to? And then it becomes another human being and not just somebody that you move around to your guys sort of thing.
Yes, absolutely. And that joins then Joyce's thing of, so who am I talking to and what am I talking about and why, So am I doing this for their well-being? For their to share this knowledge that I have and to pass it on? And who am I talking to? So like, of course you have to say, ask that, right? Because then you know what's appropriate and how to say it. Whereas if you're too close, well, then you lose sight of what's appropriate. If you come, if you become buddies with your students, well, then you no longer have that ability to take that step back and know what's appropriate. And then you buy into their projections on you too, right? And then you don't even know, well, what am I doing here? You have to see who they are, right? But if you become too close to it, then it's not going to be appropriate. You won't be able to have that necessary critical engagement to be able to discern and say, well, this is what needs to be said and not this, and this is how, and this is the relationship we have, and whatever. That's great. That's a good, I'm glad, I'm happy to hear at the university level they teach that. Well,
Good evening, everyone. Yeah, this is great. It really speaks to me a lot as well. I was going back to a class I gave this morning, mid-morning. And Roshi, when you were speaking, there was this image of the road, the way that this we set in some way, we show people, like a group of students in the class. I was going back to this experience this morning, and supposedly it's a difficult group of kids. And since yesterday was my first time with them, today was the second one. So there was some strictness, maybe, in some ways. There was a lot of limits. They were very clearly set. But it really spoke to me when I was hearing you speak before. It really, I was just showing them where is the road. Okay, so they would know. It's not about overpowering them, being more powerful than them, being stronger than them. That's not it. I'm just, the road is here. There's a limit on this side, and then there's also a limit on this side. This is where the road is. It's like I'm just showing them. Also, and this thing with the distance, I'm constantly, all the time, you are adjusting, I'm adjusting, away. So sometimes you need to be aware of the whole more, and then you are constantly, and then you move further, you move closer. There was a girl from Cape Verde. She just joined the class, I think, 2 weeks ago or something. And I arranged things. They were working autonomously for 10 or 15 minutes. So then I could go to her, just like individually, like zooming in. She didn't have the book, the school book. So, and then, if, or even if I'm on the back, it's just, I feel like I'm all the time, you are adjusting. You need to keep adjusting the distance all the time. And I was also thinking about, if I'm with a sitting group, if we are sitting and I happen to be chiquito, I'm ringing the bells, and keeping seeing the time. It's just you are showing where to go, where to walk, the road. Where is the road? The road is here. We are, you are keeping, you are noticing the time. And when you ring, basically you are just saying, even, yeah, even when we are sitting, the road is here. It's not even, this is where we need to walk or something. No, it's just like for me, it speaks very much in this sense of just showing where the road is, me keeping it. That speaks a lot to me. Just helping to show where the road is. So thank you for that.
Yep. So thank you. I think we're out of time here. Good to be here and share all this with you. Thank you.